You know, it's customary to say I'm very pleased to be here. Christian speakers tell an awful lot of lies sometimes. But it is nice to be here, not least because when you walk through the door of a church or a church meeting, you know within minutes what the ethos is. And sometimes your heart sinks and you think, oh my goodness, I've got to stand there for 3/4 of an hour and die. But when people are as nice as they've been this morning, it's lovely. And also I'm surprised to be here because last year, towards the end of the year, I became very ill for one reason, and that all cleared up. And then I developed very severe sciatica. Has anybody here had sciatica? Horrible, horrible. So painful. I could hardly move. And although Paul doesn't know it, right up to Christmas, we were thinking, how soon can we let him know that I'm not going to be here for this event? And we cancelled every other event, but not this one. And immediately after Christmas, I got a letter from the surgeon saying that all the signs of sciatica had completely gone. So here we are, which is good. So maybe there's a God after all. What do you think? There might be, mightn't there? It's a bit hard to describe Bridget and I, really. We're failed Christians. Are there any other failed Christians here? Oh, thank goodness for that. I can't bear being in places full of people walking in victory. So wearying. The title for this morning may be a little surprising to those who aren't aware of my ludicrous sense of humour. It's called Jesus, a Bad Role Model. And I did use this title once before, a thing called CRE, which is Christian Resources Exhibition. And I sent him my title, and a young man there rang me and said, we're not really very happy about your title. So I said, why is that? He said, because Jesus is a very good role model. And I said, I know. It's called irony. I said, I know that. He said, well, I don't think we can put that in the brochure. So I said, look, all right, put a question mark on the end. And that was okay. So thank you for not putting a question mark on the end. That's really good. Okay, so that's the reason for the title. And because the more you look at things the wrong way around, the easier you see them the right way around. And that's been my experience for the last 25 years in trying to explain to people something that I don't understand myself. I think becoming a Christian gets more complicated the older you get, and in a way more exciting because it's more dangerous and there are more things to discover that you never ever thought about in the early days. I suppose also we're getting a bit old, aren't we? Well, we are. I'm drawing a pension now, which is nice. Aren't pensions weird? They just arrive, don't they? I can't believe it. I love it. But we are getting old. We were in the park the other day, and I had a great big staff because of my sciatica was very bad back then. And I was walking along looking like Moses, probably, and a little boy came up behind me on a little bike and shouted, old man ahead! And I thought, you little... But he was just a little boy. In some ways, I wish I hadn't pushed him off as he went past. We're also both still diseased with flippancy. Is anyone else here diseased with flippancy? Sort of faintly waving there. It's a terrible disease, and I must apologize in advance for it, because it overwhelms me. The most ridiculous question people ever ask is, where do you find humor in the church? You only have to be awake and be there, don't you? Which cuts out a lot of Anglicans, I suppose. But it's everywhere. For example, we were on the South Coast in Brighton years ago, and a lady came up and she said, I'm really glad you're here because I want to tell you something. So I put my best here to serve you face on. And she said, I hate my church. So I said, oh dear. She said, yes, I really hate it. I said, oh dear. She said, I hate the music. I said, oh dear. Because I'd done this Christian counseling course, you see. And she said, we had a meeting in our church last night. She said, if Jesus had been there, he would have turned in his grave. Isn't that amazing? You couldn't be more comprehensively in error than that, could you? First of all, he was there. Secondly, he's not in his grave. That's the entire point of the whole exercise. And thirdly, he probably enjoys the saxophones or whatever it is she didn't like. Absolutely amazing. But you don't even have to be in the church. I mean, we collect little moments that amuse us. And we were in the canteen in the Norfolk Hospital a while ago, and there was an elderly couple, like us, elderly couple buying fruit, and the elderly lady said to the man behind the counter, I don't know if you know the Norfolk accent, that wonderful long sound that tilts up at the end, it's fantastic, I'm not sure I can do it, but she said, yeah, I like pears, and he liked pears, I like them hard, and he liked them soft, so he never gets any. You couldn't write it, could you? You couldn't write it. Absolutely wonderful. So, yeah, humour everywhere. And I'll tell you another pear story very quickly, which I wasn't going to, because I think I'm crazy about pears for some reason. We went to for lunch with a minister and his wife, and we had a very good lunch, and she said, told us she suffered from ME, which is very debilitating, and every day she has one little capsule of energy available for activity. So on this day, she'd used her little capsule of energy to do our lunch, which was very nice of her. And we had a very nice first course. It was chicken casserole, I think. It was very good. And then she hesitated. She said, I'll go and get the pudding, shall I? And we said, yes. So she went out and she came back with an upside down pineapple cake, right, which is good. And then she said, actually, I've got another pudding. I said, yes. It all seemed a bit intense for pudding, you know what I mean? She said, it's an upside down pear cake. Right, so she comes back with the upside down pear cake. And I said, pears! I love pears! I really, Bridget, trying to stop me. She knows I go stupid about pears. She said, you really like pears? I said, they're my favorite fruit, one of my favorite foods. She said, that's odd. She said, I was in Tesco's yesterday. She said, I was pushing the trolley around, collecting the stuff to make lunch. And a voice in my head suddenly said, don't get pineapples, get pears. And I thought, no, I'm not getting pears. Pears go all soft and mushy. I don't know how to cook with pears. But as she went round, this voice kept saying in her head, get pears. Get some pears. So eventually she got the pears. She made the upside down pear cake. And there I was, enjoying my upside down pear cake. So the question we all asked on that Sunday lunchtime was the God of Abraham and Isaac in Tesco's on Saturday afternoon trying to persuade my hostess that she should buy pears? Now there's a theological question that takes a bit of answering. But in a way it illustrates what we've come to believe about God. First of all, that he's really very nice. And secondly, that he does little wonderful things. That's our experience. May not be yours. So, Jesus, very bad role model. Well, for a start, Jesus was not really very good at evangelism, was he? I don't know if you've heard. Anyone here heard evangelists before? Nervous titter from the back. Did you know that evangelist is an anagram of silage vent? That pretty well proves there's a God, doesn't it? Some are very effective. I became a Christian after an evangelist came to St. John's Church in Tunbridge Wells. And I was sitting at the back, as I always do, I still do, sit at the back in church if I can. And he talked about the thief on the cross, you know, the fellow who was dying beside Jesus. And this fellow said, remember me when you come to your kingdom. And as you know, Jesus didn't say, well, it depends on your quiet time or your prayer life or your spirituality or whether you're good or whether you're bad. He just said, yes, I will. And I think we've carried that yes, that positive response, through the last 25 years of speaking to people, that what God is interested in is not fiddling about in your entrails, but saying yes. And that yes can take all sorts of different forms. So for me, that was life-changing. But when evangelists are bad, they're awful, because they can't believe you can understand or absorb anything unless it's said 39 times. And when I first started doing this kind of ridiculous thing, standing up and pretending I knew what I was talking about, I worked with an evangelist, and I was watching him see what he did so I could copy him. And I came out and read a poem very nervously. I was really nervous. And then he came out, and he said something very like this. He said, "Friends, I don't worry because I belong to God. I belong to God, friends, so I don't have to worry. Why worry when you belong to God? I don't. Would you like to know why I don't? It's because I belong to God. And belonging to God is the beginning of not worrying." So after he'd ranted on for about half an hour like this, he comes off into the wings where I was, and he said, "I'm really worried." He said, "I don't think I got through to them at all." I said, you just said you don't worry. You said it about a million times. And he said, "Oh, well, I was preaching then." So it occurred to me all those years ago that possibly there may be an opening in the church for people who tell the truth. And you have to be careful, because as soon as the church creeps into, the truth creeps into the church, you're always going to have problems. The thing about Jesus was that he never said, as some evangelists say, just come. I mean, actually, the most effective thing is to fry bacon at the front. I say anyone who makes a commitment can have a bacon sandwich. He never said, just come. He said, and read it in the Bible if you want, he said, "Go and sit down, work it out. Because if you really want to come, it's going to cost." And it does. And we are examples of that. If we had more time, we could tell you about the decisions we've had to make in our lives that illustrate the cost. And once you go through these airlocks of cost, where you don't know what's going to happen on the other side, you can't go back, really. And it's exciting, it's frightening, but it's costly. I would never say to anyone, simply walk into faith. It's rubbish. You've got to think about it. You've got to think what it means. And I'm not saying God doesn't want people, because he jolly well does. But that's what Jesus did. My second point was, it could be said Jesus colluded with thoughtlessness and selfish opportunism. He wasn't a very respectable man, Jesus. And I'll give you an example. Do you remember the story about the man whose friends let him down through the roof? Do you remember they break open the roof and they put their friend on a stretcher who's sick, and they let him down? And there he is, and Jesus heals him. Well, there's one whole raft of the church would like to retell this story. So in the new story, the friends break open the roof, they let him down, there he is on his bed there. And Jesus says, yeah, which is a sound only Christians ever make. Yeah. It's a sort of loving criticism. He would say to them, right, first of all, did you ask if you could break open the roof? No, didn't think you did. Okay. Have you paid for the roof to be mended? No, didn't think you had. Okay. You've jumped the queue. Hundreds of people waiting to come in to be healed. You, apparently, think it's okay to simply plant your friend down here and I'll heal him. You think that's right? No, didn't think so. Okay. Here's what you do. You pull him back up. You mend the roof. Go to the back of the queue. Peter will give you a number. And eventually, I might be able to to help. But it wasn't like that. He was someone who loved ingenuity and passion. Not unlike my mother, who sadly is now dead. I would love to have my mother back. I bet there are lots of people here who've lost their parents and say, I want my mum back. I really would love to have her back. But she was the sort of person, if I was with a friend and they cut their knee, I would think, oh my goodness, what am I going to do about this? And then I'd remember my mum, and I'd go to her with him, and I'd say, Fred's cut his knee. And she'd get the orange squash, and she'd get a plaster, and she'd wash his knee, and she'd put the plaster on, and she'd pat his head, and he'd be fine. And over the last 4 years, when we've done a lot of praying for people, with some interesting results, ever since we gave up thinking we could fix people, which you can't, just take them to God, you know, just take them there and say, look, our friend needs help. We don't know what to do. You can do some practical things, but the really important things are things that happen deep down. I haven't got the foggiest idea how to do that. But we have seen good things happen for people. We pray for them. So passion and ingenuity. And if you're not a Christian and the whole thing strikes you as a load of old cobblers, which it may well, just remember that those who you love and those who need your help, there may be something for them. We have a friend who's a militant atheist who looks after our dog. And he tries to go on being an atheist, but it's kind of wearing him down, I think. When I was ill, I rang him up and said, can you pray to the God who doesn't exist for me? That my legs will get better. And he said, well, I don't really believe. I said, no, yeah, but just in case there's a God, pray for me. And he did. And I'm sure God heard him, because he loves us. What else did I think? Well, Jesus was sometimes very blunt, wasn't he? We've lived in Yorkshire for some time now, so we know about blunt. We quite like it. When I first went to Yorkshire, I went up to a bar in the pub with a friend, and there was two fellows arguing at the bar, and one of them turned to the fellow who was arguing and said, hey, tell these two lads what you just said to me. They'll believe you. They look thick. And he just walked into the pub. But it's quite nice in a way. He was very blunt. Woman at the well says, no, I haven't got a husband. And he says, no, too damn right. You've got five. No messing about. Straight through to the middle of the situation. And occasionally, which is what is wonderful, a lot of restraint. So he never wanted to hurt people. When it would help, he was pretty blunt. And I have to say, Christians sometimes do like to use words to hide behind. I'm going to ask Bridget to join me. But she'll give her a round of applause to encourage her. There are little collections of words that Christians use. Perhaps to protect them from reality, I don't know. Here's a few of them. This is a sort of little sketch. Oh dear, that was quite a year we had last year. It was quite a year, wasn't it?
Oh, It was quite a year. It was a growing time.
It was a time.
When we grew, it was a growing time.
Growing time, yeah. It was a time in which we were able to grow.
To grow.
We did, yeah, we grew. It was a growing time. It was a bloody awful year, wasn't it, actually?
It was dreadful. It was terrible. I don't think I actually did any growing at all, did you?
No, I didn't. No, I threw up quite a bit. Growing.
We had that pastor, didn't we, during that year, that new pastor?
Oh, Jim, yeah, we did. Oh, yeah, lovely man.
Oh,
lovely
he
man.
Was.
Lovely
he
man.
Was a lovely man.
He was lovely.
He was lovely.
Such a lovely
a
man.
A lovely, lovely man.
Man, yeah, he was, yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't stand him myself, but he was a lovely man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a lovely example of a waste of space, he was, Jim, yeah. Mm. Do you remember Jim, that same bloke, that pastor? Mm-hmm. Do you remember he told us that we should go to that Christian play they were putting on in the church?
Oh, Oh, yeah, that terrible one we thought no one would come to.
Yeah, yeah, but he said, the Lord will bring the ones he wants.
He did.
Yeah,
he
the
did.
Lord
he did say
will
that.
Bring them. He'll
the
bring
Lord
them.
Will bring the ones he wants.
Yeah,
the ones
Lord,
he wants.
Yeah, it's a matter of faith. If he wants them, they'll come.
The Lord will bring the ones he wants.
Yeah, bring the ones he wants. He'll bring the people he wants. He brought the people he wanted that
he
evening,
did.
Didn't he?
He yeah. did. Yeah. He did. He did bring them.
Yeah.
There were three of us.
Yeah. Two of them were us, weren't they?
Yeah, and one of them thought it was an embroidery club.
Yeah, I wonder why the Lord wanted her.
Don't know. Maybe he thought it was an embroidery club.
Yeah. And they're funny, these things we say, aren't they?
What sort of things?
Well, like, I love you in the Lord.
Oh, I know what that one means. It means I don't like you very much, but I've got to be nice to you.
Yeah, that's right. What about, I sense we ought to move into prayer over this.
Oh, I know what that one means. It's I've run out of arguments.
That's right. That's yeah, right. That's right. Yeah. That's what that means. Yeah.
Anyway, you know, I'm a bit busy. Got to get on, so... Bless you.
You mean clear off, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Oh, we try not to do that. Telling the truth is awfully difficult for Christians. I mean, for pastors, for leaders, for elders, for people who passionately believe, to try to turn something into words that are accessible to other people is the task for the modern church, I think. For people to understand that we're not talking airy-fairy religious rubbish. It's something that is a passion within us. It really matters. It matters to us. Even if we fail, it matters. I suppose it is the most important thing in our lives now, really. And the truth is crucial. That you don't tell lies about what you believe and what's happening in your life. But you really keep it absolutely straight. Now, nobody avoids telling lies totally.
I'm not sure.
Has anybody here managed it over the years? When my wife comes into the kitchen with the phone in her hand, with one hand blocking the earpiece, and says, and I think, it's a lie. She says, or I say, I'm really sorry, he's out at the moment. Should be back fairly soon. It's a lie, isn't it? And I remember signing books once, and a lady came up, and I knew her like you know your sister. And her name had gone, first name. And I thought she was going to be so hurt. She wanted me to sign, you know, to her from Adrian. And I thought she was going to be so upset. So I thought, shall I tell the truth, or shall I try to be clever? Sadly, I opted for trying to be clever. I said, yeah, of course I will. Yeah, just remind me, by the way, because I don't think you ever told me, how do you spell your first name? She said, oh, I'll tell you, shall I? I said, yes, that would be helpful. She said, it's P-A-M. Sussed. That's terrible. So there are always moments where you don't quite tell the truth. But we as Christians are taught to pursue the truth, even if we don't completely manage it. Because if you don't tell the truth, you can get yourself into really stupid messes, into trouble.
Adrian.
Yeah.
You know, I just cannot stop thinking about that fantastic verse in the Bible, John 8:32. Do you know the one I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, it's one of my, you know. Yeah.
Do you know? I am so glad. I don't think I even realized you knew it.
Oh.
So, what is it that's special to you about that verse?
Well, I suppose it's the way in which, you know, God speaks through the words.
Yes.
That are in that wonderful, wonderful verse.
That's exactly what I think. So, what do you think he's saying to you?
Well, he's saying... Yeah. No, he's conveying. He's
okay.
conveying
okay.
the essence
right.
of the center
mm-hmm.
of the heart
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
of the core of the message that is central to that verse.
Which is what?
Sorry.
I'm sorry. I mean, what is the centre of the message of the verse?
Sorry, I got you. That's I didn't know what you meant. Yeah, okay. Well, the central message of the verse is so simple.
Okay.
It's so very, very simple. Basically, the central message of the verse is that everybody, no exceptions, every single person, all of us, should.
Should what?
Should get the message from the verse.
The message of the verse?
Look, these versions in the Bible vary enormously, don't they? I mean, in your translation of the Bible, what's the actual wording of that verse?
I don't know exactly. I mean, what's the exact wording in your version?
Oh, no, you're getting into so much trouble when you don't tell the truth.
Yours must be a very modern version then, Adrian, because mine simply says, Jesus says the truth will set you free.
Oh. Well, do you know, he could be right. You may... thank you. And he did say that. He said, the truth will set you free. The question is, do you want to be free? Being free is weird. Having the boundaries gone, the ones that other people impose on you and that the world imposes on you, you feel very unsafe sometimes if you're really dealing in truth. So, again, it's not something you can do lightly. Sometimes the truth approaches us from angles that we never, ever expected.
Am I going to tell them about Derek?
Yeah.
Yes, I'd love to. This is somebody, actually, we met in Scotland. He's a young man called Derek, who was about 23 when we met him. He was a very warm, outgoing, lovely guy. And one thing about Derek, one aspect of him, is that he had Down syndrome. And his mum, who was actually a single mum, bringing him up, obviously wanted Derek to fulfill his potential, to be the best Derek he could be. Well, he wasn't confident physically. And she heard there was a very amateur level of the Paralympics forming nearby. And she thought, this will be great for him physically. This will make him feel good. And she enrolled him, and he was not pleased. And he went along to his first meeting, really unhappy. And his first race was a running race. Now, Derek was fairly pepper potty in shape and not very confident. So he sets off very, very slowly and really wishing he was somewhere else. But actually, he ran past everybody else. And he got to the finishing line first, went through the finishing line and got the gold medal. Well, now he was feeling much better. And the next race that he did was a walking race. So this time, he sets off at a really good pace, head up, and is doing really, really well and is ahead of absolutely everybody. Just before he got to the finishing line, Derek stopped dead. And the person coming along behind him went through the finishing line and got the gold medal. And Derek got the silver medal. And afterwards, his mum said, Derek, why did you stop? You could have had 2 gold medals. And he looked at her as though she was mad and said, Mom, I wanted 2 medals of 2 different colours. But it's a very important thing in the middle of that. Because sometimes truths that we hang on to are things that we've just assumed are so. And in that truth, it is that there is only one goal in running a race, and that is to go through first. And there was Derek with a completely different look on that truth.
I love that story. It reminds me of what C.S. Lewis wrote about, you know, when people ask God difficult questions, it's as though they've said, what shape is yellow? We don't even understand the questions, let alone the answers. There are so many things out there to learn about reality. Right, we can't go on too long. I was going to say, Jesus was very often late. The reason he was late was because he was always messing about with people. He was obsessed with people's needs. If you'd had a time and motion expert available for Jesus, he would have sorted him out. Thank God he didn't. He's on his way to heal Jairus' daughter. You know, the famous time when Jairus, a big man in the community, asked Jesus to come and see his sick daughter. And on the way, a lady touches the hem of his robe, and perhaps he would have just walked on, but he didn't, did he? Do you want to comment on that lady? Because I like what you say about her.
Only just that the, and I know you've had this experience, the person right in front of him became the most important person in the world. The woman, poor woman, always known as the woman with the issue of blood, a woman who'd been bleeding for years and years. The thing is that she was healed the moment she touched his robe, so she was better physically. She was fine. But he wanted more than that for her. He wanted her to be whole in all sorts of ways. So he calls her out, and everybody can see her, so she can go to the temple and be clean. And she can become specialed, and she can be whatever was needed. And he took as long as it took. And yeah, I've seen it so many times with Jesus, that the person in front of him is the most important person in the world. But it is a challenge, because obviously that didn't give him a lot of approval from people just around him, really, who thought, what are you doing? And why
are
you...
I'm sure the disciples said, no, look, she's dead now. We've heard she's dead. Yes. You've blown it. And then, of course, he goes and touches her and lifts her up, and she's alive. This attitude to people is the curse of Christianity, because it demands everything from you. There are no unimportant people. So whoever you meet, whoever you're faced with, they're very important people. They may not think they are. In fact, very often they're convinced they're not. But in the eyes of God, they are. And that makes life tough sometimes, I have to say, from time to time. This Christmas was an example in a way. A lady came to see us at Scargill 3 years ago. 4 years ago? Don't know. Called Sally. And she came to pray with us, and we go along to a special room, we sit there and we're going to pray, and we said, what would you like to pray for?
Is it Scargill House in Yorkshire?
Oh, sorry,
yeah.
Scargill House, which is a
community for the last
centre,
4 years.
Yeah, retreat place where we worked for a while. And she said, well, I've got cancer, it's terminal, I know I'm going to die. She said, I've had two miscarriages and lost one child. I've now got a son, little boy, and a little girl who's younger than him. So we said, what do you want to pray for? She said, I just want to stay alive long enough for Daisy, so a little girl, to remember my face. That's what I want. I want to live another 2 years. And the forecast for her illness was that she would very soon be dying. So we did pray for her. And she did survive those 2 years, I'm very pleased to say. And Daisy will definitely remember her face. And I remember after talking to Sally one day, going to Daisy, and Daisy was very small. She's got a face like a chrysanthemum. When it opens, the smile is beyond belief. It's just wonderful. And Daisy said to me, she said, do you know what? I said, what, Daisy? She said, you know, you don't always get what you want. Oh, I thought, she's going to say something really profound now. I said, what do you want, Daisy? She said, I want a dog. And my mum won't let me have one. And I thought, how wonderful that life continued as before. And this Christmas we went to the hospice in Leeds, where Sally was full of tubes and things, and prayed briefly with her. She was very strong in herself, physically very ill, but very strong in herself. And then we heard she died about a week after that. That little family, those little lives, so important, so important. A wonderful thing happening in there. There was a fire engine outside the hospice when we got there. And when we went in, there were two firemen taking a ring from Sally's swollen finger. They had a special little machine they used to get it off. And these two big firemen were so gentle, so lovely. And she said, I might have to have another one off later on. And they said, don't you worry, you just call the fire brigade, we'll be down here. It couldn't happen anywhere else in the world, could it? But England, that you have a fire engine outside and two men removing a ring from someone's finger. I thought that was a marvelous little parable. Those people were really important, really important. I'll give you one more very quick example of that before we move on, because we have to finish. Little tiny things. I think sometimes God points things out that people need. There was a lady came to Scargill. She had learning difficulties, and just before she left, she was at the door, and I said, "So has your life been going okay then?" She said, "Well, it's all right." And she said, "Except my hamster died." So I said, "Oh dear, I'm so sorry about that." She said, "Yeah, well, his teeth got very long and they went bad, and I put him in a little cardboard box, and he just sat in there, didn't move. And I went to the vet, and the vet looked at my hamster, and he said, 'I'm sorry, he's going to have to die.' So we lost him. So I said, 'Oh, I'm really sad about that.' I said, 'Tell you what, I'll write a little poem about him before you go.' And I thought, 'What are you saying? You've got 10 minutes. And I thought, I really hope his name is an easy one to rhyme with. So I said, what was his name? She said he was called Fudge. So I thought, well, it's not too bad. So this is what I wrote, and I'd like you to live with me through this attempt to find rhymes for the word fudge. Cleaning you and feeding you, it never was a drudge, dear Fudge. Your teeth got long and bad, and God gave us a nudge. Help, Fudge. We put you in a cardboard box. You didn't even budge. Poor Fudge. We gave you to the vet, but you never bore a grudge. Sweet Fudge. We dug a little hole, and we buried you in sludge. Oh, Fudge. We stood beside your grave. It was a little muddy smudge. No Fudge. Leaving you was horrible, a slow, unhappy trudge. Bye-bye, Fudge. Hamster, hell, or heaven, who are we to judge?" She was so thrilled. It's small, but so important. We're going to have to stop sharing, but I was going to talk about the fact that Jesus did seem to encourage the use of alcohol, turning vast quantities of water into wine. I remember Steve Chalk talking about having to preach a sermon on the wedding at Cana, and he was a young minister in a Baptist church at that time, and none of the other elders wanted anything to do with it because it was alcohol, so they didn't know what to say, so they made him do it. So he did a sermon called "The Drinks Are on the Kingdom of God," and when he'd done this, an elderly man from the church came up to him and he said, "Didn't like your sermon much this morning." And he said, "Oh, why is that?" He said, "Well, it was all about drinking." He said, "Yeah, but it's in the Bible. It's there, you know, the story's there." He said, "I said, Jesus turned the water into wine." And this old fellow said, "Well, he was a young man then." Unbelievable, unbelievable. One more thing. It was very difficult to pin Jesus down. He was hopeless. Just as you thought you'd understood the rules, you knew where the boundaries were, you knew how to do it, it changed. The disciples were constantly trying to work out how to be disciples, and we still are. And it's still difficult. One of the things we've learned at Scargill, I think Bridget would agree, is to not have any aim with people other than to let God help them. And I think it's amazing what happens then. And I'll give you a bizarre example. This will make the hair stand up on the back of your neck, I tell you. We were at a place called Lee Abbey, which is another conference center, and we were going to go down and pray with people. So that day we said to each other, "Today we won't say anything unless we have something to say. Nothing. We'll keep quiet unless we have something to say." So the prayer time comes, and we're sitting in two chairs, and there's a third chair there. And some of you will know how this works. Someone comes in, miserably recounts what's wrong with them. You feel sick with horror. You can't do anything about it. You say a little prayer, and they wander off miserably again. So we're sitting there. This lady comes in. She said, "I'm suicidal," she said. "I'm on the cusp. It's so dark. I don't know what to do." And she talked about it for a bit. And I thought, I have nothing to say. Only platitudes. which I've given plenty of them out in the past. And I looked at Bridget, and she went, she looked at me. So we just sat, and time passed, and she looked darker and darker and darker. And then I suddenly remembered that earlier in the week, she'd bought a big pile of my books and paid by check for a family. And I thought, wouldn't it be a shame if she killed herself before that check goes through for the books? And I thought, I can't say that to her. So we sit, and it's the only thing in my head. The only thing in my head. So we'd promised each other, right? So I just had to take a punt at it, and Bridget thought I'd gone completely bonkers. I said, look, is there any chance you could postpone the suicide till the check's gone through for the books you bought earlier in the week?
Can you imagine how horrified
it's, it's madness. I mean, you shouldn't do that, should you? You know, there are no books on counselling that would ever say you do that. And don't do it. I mean, it's not a way to handle these things. It's ridiculous. 2 days later, she wrote to us and said that was the moment when the cloud lifted. Because she laughed. She laughed herself stupid. It's a great arrow of humour cutting into the middle of this poor lady and reminding her that there is a possibility of light. Wonderful. Laughter. I did a tour with a chap called Jeff Lucas last year, and in the interval one day, a lady came up and said, I haven't laughed so much since my husband died. And I said, I don't think you quite mean that, do you? She said, you know what I mean. I mean, I haven't laughed since then. So I said, I did know what you meant, really. But how wonderful to have a little bank holiday from grief, because grief doesn't go away. It's always there. You never lose it. The hurt is always there, but you learn ways to steer, and you have little breaks from it. It's very hard. But to learn that the mechanism is still there, sometimes God doesn't want to do religious things to people. He wants to do extremely useful, little helpful aids for them, like learning that laughter is still possible. That's very important. I'm just going to finish with one thing that I'm going to ask Bridget to read. The reflections of the love of God are everywhere in lots of different ways. Bridget's dad suffered from severe Alzheimer's, was in a very bad state. And her mum, like many wives and some husbands, devoted herself to her husband, particularly to making sure he didn't make a fool of himself, which is the great fear you have in situations like that. And she was wonderful. I mean, she was an old-fashioned Christian. She didn't ask questions about it. She just was it. So I was in this hotel in Eastbourne called the Hydro Hotel, which is probably my favourite hotel in the world. It's like an Agatha Christie novel without a corpse. It's full of very rich, very elderly people. You can almost imagine Poirot pogoing through the lobby there. And I was sitting at dinner, and breakfast rather. There was a couple on the table next to me, and clearly he was suffering from dementia, and she was protecting him. And they reminded me of Bridget's mum and dad, who sadly have gone now. And I wrote this little poem afterwards, and it's called Edward, My Love.
Oh, Edward, dear Edward, sweet light of my life, just spread out your napkin and pick up your knife. The stars shone through velvet like needles of light when you asked me to dance on the terrace that night. Oh, Edward, not croissants, too flaky, my dear. You're so good with toast. And there's marmalade here. Champagne and moonlight, lounge suit and lace. kisses and whispers, your hand on my face. Darling, don't shout. No, you know it's not Ted. It's that nice man called Stephen who helps you to bed. Morning came flowing in silvery streams as my face touched the pillow. I danced in my dreams. I'll walk in front, dear. You're so strong and tall, I need you behind me in case I should fall. I promised that night, for good or for ill, to love you forever, and, sweetheart, I will.
So that's it, really. I'm sorry, the way we talk about our faith is rather amorphous and difficult to get a handle on, and I'm pleased about that, really. I don't really want to say sorry about it, because I think the way God operates in the world is really quite extraordinary. And all I would say is to encourage people who are not Christians to not to think about joining a club, but to think about whether you want to explore whether linking into this strange, strange, humorous, crying, laughing power is worth trying or not, and what kind of cost you're willing to offer for that. And for those who are Christians, to maybe explore a bit more what God can do in the world. We've been through so many periods of doubt. Everybody does. Doubt is part of faith. But we're moving into a time now where we hang on to God because we have to. We really have to. And that's just about as much as I want to say about it, I think. Let me say a prayer. Can I say a prayer for us all just before we finish? Those who are not Christians can relax now. I'm not going to ask you to stand on your chairs while we minister to you. Father, forgive me for any nonsense I've talked and anything I've got wrong. I don't want to mess things up for you. But I do want to ask for all the people here, whatever state they're in, whatever stage they've reached, that they'll reach out to you in ways that are new and different, that they'll have a look at the fences that surround them and the boundaries that they've established in their lives and just find out whether they're the right ones. And get excited about the magic that is available. Wonderful magic. I ask that in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you very much.